Welcome to another episode of Tennessee Fro with Reading How. I'm your host, Felicia Baxter. And why I've taken up or reclaimed my name is because I can. Even though I was ranting and I was pissed off with the state of Tennessee, it's not going to change anything because I ain't going nowhere. And you can't get rid of me because I ain't going nowhere. And you can't beat me because I ain't going nowhere. Try as you might. Disappointing as most people are, I'm ecstatic, I'm elated about the turn of events over this weekend, and I wanted to share that elation with you. And also, it's podcasting time. I'm going to continue to lean into my Twitter handle, TV Food and Wine Girl. I need to add reading to that because that's what I do, and that's the name of the show. Also, thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode just as much as I've enjoyed creating it. The challenge of recording on Sunday has become synonymous for race up till you get to your next pickup goal. Sundays are supposed and should be a time of rest, contemplation, and it is. And this is my way of my ability to create these episodes, even though I'm not being paid to do it, it gives me an outlet to think things through and actually, in a nerdy kind of way, to have fun. What was a threat to that routine was a lot of the outside forces and the negative information that was coming from the outside. Once I was able to relax and once we got confirmation that Mr. Biden and Senator Harris are now our president and vice president elect, that allowed me to relax and my shoulders came down. Enter in, every now and again, I would have to pause loudly, and I would just break into insert the wobble here, because this is how I feel, and a lot of people have been celebrating the problem. But not less we forget what this says about our society. And COVID and this election has laid bare some very concerning things. Safety. I thought when I was working in Kentucky up near the West Virginia border, that was probably the start of a period in my life where I felt unsafe. And I made some arrangements. And I think my steps were ordered and I needed to come back to Tennessee and to what I thought was relative safety because of what was going on in the country at the time. Both of my homes in North Carolina are in deeply red Trump teetotalers. They have drank the Kool-Aid. And I could not and would not and cannot feel safe in that environment. And I wasn't all right. People ask you all the time, how are you doing? You just always automatically say, okay. But you actually have to admit that you are stressed. And you have to admit that you are not okay. And you have to admit to the messiness of the everyday life that you have no control over. Therein is the issue, where you just don't have enough strength to be creative, where it's just such a trial to even read a book, where it's just such a trial to get out and get moving without looking over your shoulders, and how anything can just become such a great, just so stressful just to do normal things, recycling and just being. Those are the hard or difficult things. But then when the major source of your stress has been relieved, you can actually come to terms with all of the parts of everything, your own personality, the personality of other people and people in general that you're just going to have to deal with. And Corona has become the great equalizer in a lot of things. It basically has ripped the blinds off. It has ripped down the shutters and hide in a whole bunch of messy bits. So you're going to have to come face to face with things that are upsetting, and deal with them, and being able to deal with them in a productive way, and to be able to move on. The only way that we are going to get and to regain we are as Americans, and the rest and stature and the rest of the world is together, because we're coming up against some type of bizarro future. And my friend Cheryl actually made a comment. There are 70 million people. Let's not forget those bitches. There are 70 million people that decided to vote for something and someone that is just so not with what democracy is. We have to come to terms with that. But democracy, this was a hard-fought race. It was ugly and it was despicable. But democracy did win out. And I'm believing that I'm faithful in saying that I'm on the right side, going to be on the right side of history, the way that I voted. But we got 70.3 million people that voted the other way. And this is a referendum on a lot of ill will, falsehoods, and feelings of half of the Americans that basically say it is okay to not like women. It is okay to allow other people to suffer as long as I get mine, and as long, and I don't care if it doesn't affect me. And you shouldn't want to have my American dream, because it's not like there's enough for all of us, when that is a lie. That is the reckoning right there. And what is it about democracy and what the parts of the American life that are worth fighting for and securing besides all that? And how do we reconcile that with all the other messy bits? It's like there's a schizophrenia or a bipolarness of the American dream. And we don't want to be right in the middle, where there's plenty, where you're safe, where you can be, you can demand to actually have the best health care, and the better use of technologies is available, and access is available for everyone. I honestly think they're going to be, the super rich are going to be with us, the super poor are going to be with us, and where you meet in the middle is anybody's guess. But you should have the desire to try to get out of one of those extremes or another. And looking at what parts of the values are worth securing, and how does that look? How does that plan forward look? Is it worth trying to secure up those things when we're bleeding as far as ethics, as far as morality and mortality, those types of things? However, and I love Biden's propensity to be very straightforward speaking, even with the stutter. It is very clear. He is going to be the president of all of us. He's going to work hard for us to get control of this epidemic and shore up the economic damage because of lack of management of the pandemic that he and President Obama fought for just 8 years ago, just 12 years ago. They inherited also a shit show of grand proportions, and they were able to turn it around. He has the experience. I know he can do it. And he has his sister, many sisters, Senator Harris, African-American foremost, of Indian heritage, of utmost. I honestly think she's going to be an amazing vice president. And she, both of them give us hope again to be able to dream again. What Donald Trump basically taught us, you can even be a dumbass failure and you can still become president of the United States. That's the negative connotation of his administration. And it's very sad to say, however, that's what you get when you get a democracy. Anyone with the stamina and you can get the votes and get elected, you can absolutely serve in that capacity. You can fake your psychiatric examination. There's no minimum IQ. And we got to really probably start looking at the ethical ramifications of actually electing a sociopath as a president. But that's just me. And what also irks me when you get people, other white old men like Dr. Phil, basically saying, you don't know this person. Well, I can only judge based on what they have said and their actions in the public eye. That is how I have come up with my determination and my perception. I can only determine what I don't like about your actions from what you actually do. And your actions show me that you are a lying sociopathic fool and you need to go away. That is the bottom line with that. And I can see that. And what also disturbs me, that 70.3 million people, 55 of them being women, voted for this lying sociopath. And I can't, it's going to take me a minute to get over that because I hold grudges. I'm that vindictive fool that is going to remember every negative thing that you actually did because I put it in my mental Rolodex and then I can pull it out at the drop of a hat. Don't ask me where my key car keys are, but I can tell you what you did and about roughly what time you did it if it was dumb in the past. That is the kind of vindictive grudge holder that I am. But, and we also live in a democracy where there is free speech. If you want to hold on to those toxic, backwards rhetoric, beware that you're going to be judged for it and we're going to drag you. And don't whine when we basically call you on it and you suffer the replications for it, either by getting voted out of office, being called and made to resign because you're doing something that is truly egregious, illegal, and you should not be doing it. Just because you can say it, should you say it? Nah. And don't get mad and start whining when we call you out on your dumbass rhetoric. That is the way it goes. What I find sobering is this fool could get, if he doesn't get locked up right away, he's probably going to have a whole Trump show, or they're going to develop a whole network devoted to hatred and lies, and anybody that's willing to support and spew that, I believe, because he's had some very powerful and money backers, that he is going to get a show if he doesn't have to actually do a podcast from his jail cell. That's just how we are in America. Does it mean that he shouldn't say it? Of course not, but he is going to say it. And he's going to become, after Rush Limbaugh passes away, he's going to actually take up the right-wing, stupid statements of that predecessor. And there is a market for it. We got 70 million people that are willing to watch that show. You'll get your Nielsen rating. You'll stay on air and you will malign everything, the right and moral and ethical means. So there you go. And I knew number one, I really can't go anywhere because there's a lot of financial and legal ramifications of being a nomadic electronic worker. In order for you to get tax benefits that you can write off or exemptions, you actually have to be out of the country almost 3/4 of the year or 330 days. You have to mostly get legal permission. It is harder because from a tax standpoint, you could end up in tax audit hell, and I ain't fitting to go out like that. So that to me doesn't make a whole bunch of sense. But as I say at the top of this segment, I am in Tennessee. I ain't going nowhere. You can't make me go anywhere. And I will keep my position as long as they'll have me. And that direct deposit hits my paycheck, my bank account, allowing me to be able to pay the bills and also to have off-duty creative interests. I don't want to hurt myself. I don't want to hurt anybody else. I just want to become more creative and be an entertaining. And I don't have to do that at the detriment of other people unless you say something really egregiously stupid and I'm going to have to call you out on it. But this is the land that I live in. This land is actually my land. And it's your land too, if you pay your taxes. The beauty of the America, that's why I also started out with listening not only to trap music, but also noted American patriotic hymnals. America the Beautiful, or My Country Tis of Thee, is on the top of that. But also that folk song, This Land Is Your Land, is more apparent, and it's come to me in the last several weeks too, about because how divided we've all been and how it seems like the American dream is only for a certain small group of people that look like the Chumps and his families, and the McConnells and the Lindsey Grahams of the world. And shame on you for wishing to share in this dream, because this really is not for you. And just get in your place and accept it. Well, not so much. What the vote actually has done to say that, number one, we do have to do this together. You can have different opinions, but don't malign other people and try as far as you might to disenfranchise them. Also, from going after the same pursuits as you. Just because I don't look or sound like you or have your same conservative, red, Republican views doesn't mean that I don't deserve a place at the table or the ability to make my own damn table. This land really is my land. Was born here. I was raised here. I work here. I'm going to help build it up and to protect it. And I'm going to enjoy my time right where I am. I ain't going nowhere. I am Tennessee Fro. And that's all I got to say about that. One of the greatest things about doing this podcast is staying true to all of my pursuits and my downtime. And I love watching TV. I get to disconnect, just get my mind right. And I find enjoyment in rolling up on a show that I wouldn't have necessarily been interested in. I have been watching a lot of HGTV, coming up with my own episode of fixer-upper or gut this house with the purchase of a historical home, doing some renovations to preserve the architecture and that Victorian, the end of the Victorian, more Edwardian era beauty of that home, and being able to hire designers and architects and African-American agents and contractors in the beauty of that. So I've been getting all these ideas by watching HGTV. But at the same time, I use it as a way to just basically just disconnect and not to think too hard on the trials of the day. And I did rewatch, and I'm going to probably end up binge watching it again, Lovecraft Country. I think it's on HBO. It's either HBO or Cinemax or Showtime, one of them. It is a great story. Suspense, mystical in a lot of ways, about with African Americans at in lead positions, and how in the 50s and 60s how they navigated extreme racism and homophobia, and they to protect themselves and their family. It's a great, it's well written. The cinematography is amazing. And seeing black women with their natural hair and their curvaceous bodies being glorified, I found it to be uplifting. Some of the scenes is very violent and are grotesque, but it also gave me hope in just the power of the black woman. Also, I will be doing a separate episode, probably won't post that until after the football game tonight, about Star Trek Discovery this past week. But I'm still a Trekkie, always will be a Trekkie, forever the Trek. I think you should be watching a film that is starring Viola Davis and the late Chadwick Boseman. They finished filming this right before he passed away a few months ago. And it drops. It's Netflix. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. That is actually premieres, again, as I said, on Netflix in December. So that is what a couple of things, besides the Cowboy Steelers game, that I think you actually should be watching today. But definitely that show, that particular movie, and I'm thinking it's going to be a biopic about the blues singer Ma Rainey, obviously. And that is another thing that I'm going to need to look up, that I think I'm going to give you a little bit of a historical reference. Who the hell is Ma Rainey? And why should we watch a story about her? So this is from Biography. Ma Rainey was the first popular stage entertainer to incorporate authentic blues into her song repertoire, and she became the mother of the blues. She also, her music served as the inspiration for such poets as Langston Hughes. And she was described by Sterling Brown, a person of the folk. She had, her beginnings were in Columbus, Georgia, part of the minstrel troopers, Thomas Pridgett and Ella Allen Pridgett. She worked at the Opera House in the 1900s. She was a singer and dancer in a bunch of Blackberries. And she married William Pa Rainey, and then they were billed as Ma and Pa Rainey. They toured the South in tent shows and cabarets. And it wasn't until she basically traveled outside of the South and met up with Bessie Smith. That's when she actually got into her own and her own stylistic, her own musical stylism, and she was actually got her sound and became the great entertainer that we know of her today. That's pretty amazing. And she died in Rome, Georgia. On December 22nd, 1939. I wonder if we know how she died. How did she die? Or what did she die? Or the cause of death. I wonder if she, the complications of congestive heart failure or diabetes, because she's a thicker girl.
Here's your kitchen. This is one of my favorite rooms in the house.
Let's see. Early career, recording career, death. She actually had an amazing life and extension. She had a heart attack at the age of 53, really. But she owned like 3 theaters. She was still performing up until her death when, she absolutely passed away. There's a Blues Hall of Fame right here in Tennessee. It honors those who performed. The actual building hall opened to the public in 2015. It's at 421 South Main Street in Memphis, Tennessee. And she actually features predominantly in it, as well as Muddy Waters, Memphis Minnie, B.B. King. That's pretty awesome. I really like that. I'm glad I took the time out to kind of look up who this huger than life, larger than life African-American woman was. And I'm sure that Viola Davis is going to bring something to the role in recreating this larger than life individual. I'm excited about this movie coming out. I think her, and plus King T'Challa is in it, Chadwick Boseman. I wonder if he's Pa Rainey, huh? But anyways, I think she's going to do a great service, and I'm excited about seeing this movie. So thank you for creating this, Netflix. Thank you, Viola, for taking the playing the role. And this is how I'm going to end this segment of what I'm watching. I'm starting to notice that the New York Times Magazine is becoming a great source of unexpected source of possible ideas to work or to for recipes. A big part of my Twitter handle is food and wine. Well, two of those things got the 1-2 punch in this week's Sunday edition of the New York Times Magazine. Last week, I made a vegetable stew out of that was chickpeas based, but I actually had to add beef because that's just how I roll. However, they also have, because I think I could make this. I think I am going to make this. There is something, it's called a onion tart from the, it's from a New York or some elegant Michelin star restaurant at, is it Lucci? Lutici? It's a, it is a New York restaurant with classic elegance and French cooking. And it seems like it's actually pretty easy to make. As a testament to it is flour and kosher salt. I actually have the ingredients, unsalted butter. I'm going to have, I do have bacon fat, y'all. How crazy is that? Yellow onions. I would have to get some heavy cream because I do have nutmeg and black pepper from my making of that, brief samir from last week. But that seems like it would also go extremely well with this. What caught my eye was another wine club, if you're into that type of thing, from the National Geographic. And I'm hoping one of these people actually know that I'm giving their props out for free. Navigate to natgeo.wine/197-1004, to join the wine club. And as the one of their free gifts, there's a $49.97 value bonus, where you get three bottles of award-winning reds that tells the story of a different threatened species. I love the artwork or the photography of the condor, this wildcat and a frog on a salamander, excuse me. As the bottle art for these bonus gifts from the National Geographic. How they're bringing great 93 points and above bottles of wine to the public and above, and using the proceeds to basically talk about and preserve and support these endangered species. So I think that was ingenious. And anything that has cute animals on the pages or on the art, I'm all for. So check out this onion tart recipe. I'm going to probably make that probably sometime this week. And I do have also a use now for that bacon relish I bought from a local restaurant here, as well as pairing it with a great bottle of red. Definitely order now through natgeowine.com/197-1004 to take advantage of their special offer, as well as learning the stories of the threatened species. So on to my favorite thing to do in a week, besides reading the Sunday New York Times. I've noted in the last couple of episodes how the pickings have been slim, not only for adult nonfiction and fiction, but also definitely for kids. But it is in this week's version that they have an entire children's book edition, which I completely am enthralled with. I'm thinking about cutting it a little bit short, and also possibly, I'm thinking I'm going to still be able to do it, but I'm going to basically utilize the selections from this week's segment to talk even more about all of the selections that they actually made in this week's books. I think it's apropos because we are in history with the nomination of both Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, who is the VP-elect. She is a senator, but she grew up in California, came to the top of the assistant, or actually she was the attorney general for the state of California, and it was then voted in as senator representing her state, and now she's making the first black African-American and Indian of Indian descent to be at that highest, one of the highest of office. And I definitely can go on to see her run for president again and actually win it. I think that's amazing. And I'm so proud that she represents me. This is how, if you have to have a woman to rep you, she is that woman. So I'm going to actually start right there with a couple of selections for the adult selection. Unladylike, A Look at Gender Roles and Those Who Refuse Them. The Surprising History of Future of Girls Who Dare to Be Different. I can't see Senator Harris as as a tomboy, but she definitely kicked out the gender script with her rise as a prosecutor, and then as a senator, and now as the VP. She is absolutely amazing. So she would fit right in there, not fitting that role of an African-American woman or just a woman in general. And even though I'm going to be putting this into the children's section, but this book about Finish the Fight, the brave revolutionary women who fought for the right to vote. And I mentioned that because as a nod to the women's suffrage, which just turned 100 years old this year, Kamala Harris wore all white. And that wasn't lost on me. I thought she looked fly in it, but it was basically a nod to that. And it's more, if the cover is any indication, it seems like it is a more inclusive depiction of all of the women that fought for our rights to vote as they rep their own class of Americans, from the Chinese American who led one of the first suffragette parades, to Stacey Adams' contested loss in the 2018 gubernatorial race, how they cheated and how that actually has come back to secure the vote for Joe Biden. And women like Nannie Bell Burroughs and Carrie Williams Clifford. And the Mexican suffragists, Jovita Idar, and the Dakota Sioux writer and activist, Zikala Sa. And then Elizabeth Piper Inslee, who fought for racial integration within the suffragette movement. I'm hopeful that they will talk about Ida B. Wells. She was more on the anti-lynching tip, but she also did so much for as an insular agitator outside of the movement, for what is right and also to do what is right for the vote. So bravo. This is, I'm assuming it was put together by former and present reviewers, and I'm excited that you basically should let all little girls and boys and non-binary just read this book to actually see people like them in the movement and that have their place also in history. Also, in this week's, there's a book called The Living is Easy by Dorothea West. It was initially published in 1948. She was a member of the Harlem Renaissance, but it satirizes the Black bougie. Its heroine escapes her sharecropper roots by marrying an entrepreneur and strives to distance herself from her quote-unquote lower caste neighbors. I'm wondering if this and how closely this ties with Bumpy Johnson's wife. She's fair-skinned. He's a quote-unquote gangster entrepreneur. But I'm wondering if that is what that is about. And it was, as it says, it was originally written during that period of time. So it'd be interesting to find out if she basically was throwing shade. So Memorial is a book about how do we determine how racist we are and how you determine what you are through your race, nationality, and sexual orientation and family. This is a book about the story of Mike, a Japanese American male, and his African American partner, Ben, and how even though Mike's father abandoned them when he was little, he basically flies back to Japan on an emergency basis when he basically falls terminally ill, and how his mother at the same time is coming to visit him in Houston, and they basically, she and Ben get stuck together, and you see some of her racist comments that he actually is familiar with Japanese food, and he actually eats it and enjoys it, and she basically throws shade at that ability of a Black man to know what certain things are, etc. It also has powerful themes, how families, which you can't pick, have immense power to well over the children, even into their adulthood, and how they are still capable of wounding them. It basically, I don't know if this is his first novel, but the tone of the review, it seems like it could have done a better job of clarity from the vernacular, what I would call it. It could have been, they said it could have been more polished and it would have made it even a better book, but it seems like it is, as it stands right now, it is probably a good read, and I'm going to be adding that to the shelves of Chatterbooks. Let's see, towards the back, there's also, they also talk about Charles Dickens, because it's the 150th anniversary of his death. I'm not really into Charles Dickens besides the Christmas Carol. So I'm not going to be adding that at this time. But maybe consider adding it as far as when we get closer to Christmas, because I'm planning on truly doing my 12 podcasts of Christmas again, because I found that to be more successful and I was able to actually get more downloads with that theme. So maybe this is what I'll take for the rest of this month, preparing for that particular podcast. Maybe with a separate theme. I was actually focused last year on themes and traditions from different parts of the world. Maybe I'll do a food-based theme and just basically look about different Christmas traditions as far as the United States, since it's not safe for us to be able to celebrate in this upcoming season. But that will actually be, that's to be determined later. So getting into the additions to the children's and young adult portions of Chatterbooks, there were so many great selections, highly illustrated books that I think if you expose your kids, or if I had been exposed to these types of books, I would have even had a more expanded, love of reading. There Must Be More Than That. It was written and illustrated by the Japanese artist and writer Shinazuki Yoshitaki. It's working with a big problem, in this case, the future, and recasting it in an approachable, humorous way that a young kid can actually deal with. There's also Little Audrey's Daydream, The Life of Audrey Hepburn, written by her son and his wife. And that is exactly what it is. From her growing up in Europe during World War II, the occupation and the food storages and the near starvation. And she, in spite of all of that, dared to dream of the life that she would want in the movies. And all of it came to fruition, as told by her son. Then there is The Kiosk, which is a funny, funny book. I'm thinking a book about this benevolent big girl that has a travel book kiosk, and she gets so fat that she can't get out. So she's basically trapped into her by design, eating snack and reading about travel books about places she can't go, because her food and her gluttony has actually got her trapped in that the kiosk. There's also the book Twins by Varian Johnson, how in the sixth grade, the twins, Maureen and Francine, who now wants to become Fran, wants to change their little buddy, consistent, simpatico, when they basically both decide to run for the president of the class, and how their once strong relationship is tested as they're both strive to be different and individuals, even though they're identical twins. There's The Magic Fish, which is a comic book by the artist Trung Lee Nguyen. It's a variation of two well fairy tales, and it's told through the eyes of a contemporary Vietnamese American teenager. Tien is gay and struggling to find the words to come out to his immigrant family. Wow. That is art imitating life. And I think in a curious or a questioning teenager, that may seem like it would be a good read for them. And then there is the new take on The Little Mermaid. It's by the author and illustrator Jerry Pickney. The farm's just tons of fun. You don't have to look very far to have a really good time. It's on the original Disney-esque movie, but it's a pinning over the love of a handsome prince, Pickney's mermaid named Melody, who befriends a human girl of the similar age, Zion. They both immediately feel a kinship, and the strength of their connection allows them to find ways to communicate. After learning Melody's story, Zion encourages the mermaid to reclaim her voice, both literally and figuratively, to save the human and ocean worlds from the sea witch's destruction. basically is two little African-American girls out to save a world of somebody else. And how they're two different beings, but they still have an affinity for each other. I think acceptance and being able to communicate and listen is key in any relationship. And this told through the voice of children is how we're going to be taught to get back to get together and to be able to talk through some things. And there is the book by Brian Collier, All Because You Matter. They call it stunning and powerful. And it's a celebration of young black lives. I think that's going to be a good read. As I said before, you got to have your little girl, boy, and questioning kid read Finish the Race. And also Food for Thought. There's three books celebrating different ethnicities' food. Measuring Up by Lily Lamott. A Place at the Table by Sadie Farouk and Lauren Chauvin. American as Paneer Pie by Supriya Kelkar. And The Surprising Power of a Good Dumpling by Y. Chim. They had me at Food for Thought. I thought that was actually pretty cute. And how the author or Catherine Hung would dream of all of these English and anglicized foods that was so different from her Korean stews that she got used to with what she had growing up, and how she was engrossed by those foods as she grew up reading as a kid. Then there is the books about books section and the people that write them. There is One Girl by Andrea Beatty. It's a downcast girl who sits alone at dawn outside of the dark house. And then a meteor drops to earth, and basically from it springs word and poems and books. I think in a fantastical way, it's a way to celebrate the art of writing and the art of books to transport you to another world. Calvin Gets the Last Word. It says, see that kid reading a book? That's Calvin. And I'm the book. I'm Calvin's dictionary, and I'm tired. So begins this book's eye view of a young boy's love of words. So this is basically the book, the dictionary, calling shade on Calvin for using and being too inquisitive. That's cute, too. The Lady with the Books is a story inspired by the remarkable work of Jella Lettman. She... Annalise and her little brother Peter wander from Munich's post-war to rubble into Lettman's 1946 traveling exhibition of 4,000 children's books she hoped would create bridges of understanding. When their real-life counterparts begged to take a book home, Lettman translated the story of Ferdinand, banned when Hitler was in power, about a bull who didn't want to fly into German and had 30,000 copies printed. So this is a story of one woman's zeal to preserve the words and to get books into the hands of people that and to get the hand and people of everybody. So how awesome is that? The Magic Bookcase is about a goblin who guides readers through a 20-foot long fold-out reproduction of the massive mural ink pen painted of a room with bookcase walls, where instead of the great storybooks themselves, their most careful characters come to life. The Library Bus, I didn't have this one circled, but I caught a glimpse of this. This is written by Barham Rahman, illustrated by Gabrielle Grimmer. It's a five-year-old Perry's first day as her mother's library helper. But this is no ordinary library. This one is on wheels. In a story inspired by the first library bus in Kabul, Afghanistan, where Rahman grew up during the Civil War, it brings books to girls in remote villages and refugee camps who have no access to education. When it arrives, their cheeks blush with hope, like Pari's magenta dress against Grimmer's richly nuanced saffron sand sky. Mama, who had to hide in a basement to study when she was young, reads aloud. Learning, she reminds Pari, is what will make us free. Learning to read is what will make you free. Powerful, powerful words. And that's where I'm going to end this section. Books will make you free. Learning will give you the knowledge to keep you free. And that's how I'm going to, not really how I'm going to end, but that's where we end this week's episode. And please do me a favor. Listen to the episode. Look at the list of books at Chatterbooks. Please leave me comments as well as suggestions about additions to my ever-growing selections of books, novels, fiction, and nonfiction. If you had a rough week like I did and you know there's a number of people that need a bag of gummy penises, please navigate to shipabagofdicks.com/tinfro-got-jokes and use my promo code tinfro-got-jokes to get a percentage off of your shipment as well as the actual cost of shipping. And as always, I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I've enjoyed creating it. And don't worry, you guys. I know we're almost at the finish line, the end of this crap of a year 2020. We got so much to be hopeful for. I know that you're tired, but I'm going to still ask you to continue to remain vigilant and be careful in these COVID times. And again, thank you for joining me, and I'll see you next week. Bye.